Thank you very much, Ms. Simmons. I'm very privileged to return to Michigan State once again. It's getting to be a regular thing, it seems. And I must say I enjoy it very much because it's like coming home. I have a number of places I call home other than Atlanta and Marion, Alabama, where I was born, reared. So Michigan State and the home of the Robert Greens, another one of my homes. So it's good to be back here, in a sense, with another one of my families. I think it's very important to feel at home wherever you happen to find yourself. And in as much as this class is dealing with minority families, it's nice to be a minority and feel at home in a setting like this. And I think that's really part of what it's all about in terms of finding our places in our settings and in our society. I'm going to talk briefly with you about my upbringing, and then I would like for you to feel free to ask questions of me, because I really believe that there ought to be an exchange. I find myself sometimes talking too much, and sometimes I believe that if people had a chance to ask questions, and if I could be brief enough with my answers, then you'd maybe learn much more that way. I grew up in Marion, Alabama. And you say, where in the world is Marion, Alabama? Well, it's a small town about 30 miles from Selma. And then you say, well, where's Selma? Selma, Alabama is about 50 miles from Montgomery. Well, that rings a bell. I think for most of you, you've heard of Montgomery, Alabama. But Marion, Alabama is about 80 miles between Birmingham and Selma in the central part of Alabama. And you say, well, when was that? Well, that was a long time ago. Believe it or not, it'll soon be half a century. In those days, the South, the rural South where I grew up, was very, very much segregated. Blacks and whites had different lifestyles. I grew up in a family of three children and my parents. I was fortunate in that I had both parents in my home. My father and my mother were both, they both grew up in the same area. I was also fortunate in that I grew up on the farm of one of my grandparents. My grandfather, Jeff Scott, owned a farm of more than 300 acres of land. Now, Jeff Scott bought his farm sometime around the early part of the century. Also, my other grandfather on my mother's side, the McMurray side, also owned their land. So that I was fortunate in having two farms that I could visit and play with my cousins, and in a sense we had what I think a very healthy kind of existence. We grew our own vegetables and we also grew our own fruit. And during the season of the fruit, when the fruit was in season, especially the peaches and the plums and grapes and things of that kind, I found myself sitting under the peach trees and sometimes carrying around a lap full of peaches. I don't know whether you know what a lap is, but when you wear a dress and you put things in the front of your dress and then you raise your skirt, you make a lap. Well, that's what we call a lap. So I would carry around a lap full of peaches and a knife and continue to eat peaches during that season. My mother always said that I used to gain weight during the fruit season because I ate so much fruit. Well, I still eat a lot of fruit. My parents had my father a sixth grade education and my mother third grade education. They went to school about 3 months out of the year, and that was the way it was. This was, no one in their community had, who was black, had more than 3 months education. When I came along, of course, I remember having 7 months schooling, and then the white kids had 9 months. So you can see right there was an inequality. Blacks and whites were totally separate in every aspect of their living. But because we lived on a farm with my sister, my older sister, Edith, and my younger brother, Obi Leonard, we were somewhat protected from the kind of hostility and direct contact with whites in the South. But it was my father who had to face the insults and the indignities that were hurled at him as he tried to earn a living for his family. My father was a very, and he is still alive, by the way, both of my parents, at 71 and 76. My father, 76. My father was a very industrious man who, if he had had enough education, the conditions had been different, if he had lived in a community where he could have gotten the kind of education that was provided for the people other than blacks, he could have been if he had been white, he probably would have been the mayor or even the governor of the state, because he was a very, very intelligent man, very, what we'd call ambitious, and did become very successful as a businessman, a small businessman, in much later years. But during the period when we grew up, it was quite a struggle. My father and mother were married in 1921, and my father never liked the farm that he grew up on. After they were married for some years, later in the 1920s, late 20s, when our country was going into the Depression years, my father left the South and came to Detroit to find work. And of course, he stayed in Detroit for a number of months looking for work every day, and there was no work. So he decided to go back South. you can imagine what it might have been standing in those long lines and the humiliation that one went through. And of course, we are in a very similar period right now in our urban centers across the country. There's just no, there are no jobs for those people who need work to take care of their families. My father went back south, and finally he worked around at odd jobs, and he decided to buy himself a truck. And with this truck, he hauled lumber. In the south, there's a lot of pine timber. And the pine timber was cut, and it was shaped into lumber at the sawmills. And he was hired to haul the lumber from the woods to the city depot, where it was then shipped on for purposes of building and so on, shipped on to be processed for building purposes. My father was the only black who owned a truck, who bought his own truck. Well, actually, he couldn't buy it himself, but he had to borrow the money to buy the truck. But in borrowing the money to buy the truck, he enslaved himself to the white man who loaned him the money. And this white man happened to own a lot of land. He had a lot of blacks living on his plantation who worked for him. And also he had a large store, general merchandise store. Most of the people who lived on his land would come to his store and purchase their groceries, and first of all, to get paid off. And the pay was very, very little at that time. So if you lived on a white man's place, they sort of paid you whatever they decided they wanted to pay you, and the wages were very, very low at that time. Of course, it varied from time to time. If you were working in the fields, you might get 40 cents a day. If you were picking cotton, there was a time when you'd earn maybe 40 cents for 100 pounds of cotton. Then it was raised to 60 cents. And finally, when you got paid a dollar a day, that was very good money. In those days, it took much less to live, but the fact is those were still very low wages for the amount of work that was done. Now, my father didn't work on the farm, as I said, very little he did. We had a small farm, truck farm, where we grew our vegetables and raised some corn and a few other things. My grandfather raised cotton and all of the other vegetables that one usually raises on a farm. Both of them did. But when my father hauled his lumber, and at the end of the week, 2 weeks period when he was to get paid, most of the time he would only get a balance due, because all of his money went toward the debt that he owed. The truck that he had asked the man to loan him money to buy took him a long time to pay for it. And that meant that the family, to some extent, suffered, because we only had our food. We could get food from the store, we could get clothing. My mother used to buy cloth, and my grandmother used to sew, and so she sewed, made dresses for my sister and me, and shirts for my brother. Well, how did he earn a living? He had to find odd jobs. And because my father was very creative and industrious, he always had odd jobs to do. He taught himself how to be a barber, so he used to cut hair on weekends. We used to have men coming to our house to get the hair cut on weekends. Also, he used to haul used to gather scraps of iron from old automobiles that had been abandoned, and other kinds of steel like that he would gather, and he would haul that and sell it. Also, he would take people places, and finally, you know, he went into the taxi business. But during the process of trying to make a living, I remember my father talking about how he was intimidated by the whites who were working with him, alongside of him, with his truck. Being the only black, he was in competition with the other whites, and they were all poor in a sense. We had a sense of dignity and self-respect because we owned our land. We did have something that we could be proud of. At the same time, we felt proud of the fact that though we were black and we were discriminated against, that we had been taught that we were just as good as anyone else. My father's father, mother had taught him that. My mother's parents had taught her that. Though my grandfather, Mac Murray, was a slave, he was 2 years old when the Civil War ended. But at the same time, he taught his children a sense of respect, and the fact that he worked hard and earned money to buy his own land, to have a sense of independence, gave the children that feeling and sense of independence also. One thing about my childhood that stands out very strongly is that my parents, my grandparents, were very, very religious and had a very strong religious faith. I think this is very true of many of the rural black families. The church plays a very important role in the life of rural black families. And this is part of a tradition from the period of slavery, in that blacks turned to the church and to their religion as a source of refuge, as a source of hope, when there was nothing else that could give us that sense of hope. We find in our religious music, the spirituals, the message of salvation, yes, but many times it was not referring to a salvation over yonder, but the spirituals were used as code words to carry on the kind of struggle for freedom, even in those very dark days, so that we felt somehow we were all children of God, and that God loved all of his children, and therefore we could walk with pride, and we wanted. And one of the things that blacks in my community valued was education, because education was a way of, in a sense, freeing oneself. I don't remember when I felt that I had to go to college, but I always remember, as far back as I can remember, that I wanted to go. And I felt that I was going, and somehow my parents must have instilled that desire in me to go to college to get an education. But I remember my mother saying to me that you get your education and be somebody. Word being somebody is something that many of us who are black have been told many times. You have to be somebody. And so we learn that early that if we wanted to be respected, we had to be somebody. But even being somebody didn't always bring respect, we found in the situation which I grew up. Because in my father's case, he was not respected in the sense that we would have hoped that he would have been in those days. But I think because he was hardworking and because he was honest, because he did his job well, he always believed in doing the job well. He used to say, do it well and not at all. And because he exemplified so much courage, I think that, you know, in a sense he was feared. When he confronted the whites who made attacks, personal attacks on him, there were verbal abuses. And later on in his life, he actually suffered physical abuse. But the verbal abuses, he always stood tall and looked his accusers straight in the eye. And he always said that if you look a white man in the eyes, he can't harm you. So this is what he did when he was attacked, simply because he was trying to make a decent living for his family. They would stop him on the highway, and these were the men that he was working with, take out their guns and threaten to kill him. And instead of running away, he stood tall and said to them, I have been assigned to do this, and I'm just doing my job. And he was not what they call impotent or anything like that. But because he did not run away, I think that his life was spared. I know that this was a very difficult thing for him because he had a family. But I used to hear him talk to my mother when he came home at night about the attacks and so on. And he used to say to her, I don't know whether or not I'll be back tonight. And naturally, this was very, very frightening to me and to my sister and my brother as young children. So I lived in my early life with those kinds of threats, not knowing what might happen to my father and that his life might be taken at any time, and for no really good reason at all, except that there was this feeling of competition and dislike because here was a man who somehow got a little better break than the others, they thought. Well, we still have that problem in many situations today. The whole effort to play one blacks against whites in the present job market is no different from what my father experienced in those days. It's a more sophisticated way of doing it. But we still have those problems with us today. One of the things about growing up in the South and on a farm as I did, I think it gave our family a greater sense of stability, even with the threats and intimidations, because we had a sense of security in our land, the fact that nobody could run us off the land and off our place. This did happen in many instances in surrounding communities. When blacks had some disagreement with the person that they worked for. It was very easy to tell them to leave the place where they lived, and then they didn't have any place to go. But in our case, we always had a home and a place to live. Though our home was not one that was very, very comfortable, houses in the South and even the white homes were rather crudely built. They were small and unpainted and made of boards. So this is the kind of home that we had, but it was home, and for us there was security in that home. So unlike those people who came to the urban centers, we had that sense of togetherness with our families, our grandparents, our aunts and our uncles, the extended family concept that is now felt to be so important has been lost, or is lost, as we become more urbanized in this country. I think that we as Black people have known about this for a long time. It's been one of the ways that we have survived. As I recall, most of the families in my community did own their own land. In my immediate community, they owned their own land, just as my parents had been the heirs to the land that their parents owned. Other families in my community had the same experience. And as I go back to Marion, Alabama today, that condition still exists in terms of Blacks owning a significant part of the land in the area where I grew up. And I think that speaks very well, in a sense, for those people, and for the fact that there is a kind of, well, as I said, there's a kind of stability within the community and within the family situation when there is land and when people are able to, you know, to live continuously on the land. Now, one would ask, what happened to you? How was it that you were able to leave the rural South? And some of you know that I went to college at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Well, I went to a school after elementary school. Elementary school training was very limited. I had to walk 4.5 to 5 miles one way to school every day, to a two-room school. And at first it was one big room and then two rooms. So that was an improvement, 3 grades in each room. We had one high school in the county, and that was 20 miles away. That high school was for Blacks. The high school that was closest to us was in Marion, Alabama, and that was 9 miles away. But it was a private high school, semi-private. By the time my sister and I went there, we had to pay tuition to go to that school. It was one of the schools that was founded by the church, the American Missionary Association of the Congregational Church, right after the Civil War. Blacks in the South, and the missionaries went south to teach in that school from the earliest days. By the time my sister and I went in the late 30s, the school had Black and white teachers, half Black and half white, and they were wonderful people who had a great sense of service and dedication and a great sense of values. Of course, I didn't say anything about the values of my home, but I think that had I not had parents who were very honest and religious, and they believed, they gave love. We didn't talk a lot about love as such, but they exemplified love in their attitudes toward us and toward other people. A sense of giving and sharing, and a sense of responsibility toward other people who were in need, and also the values of it on education, value in education. That was all part of what I learned in my from my family. But then at Lincoln High School, where I went to school, my values were further. They were strengthened, and I learned that for the first time that there were some pretty decent and loving white people who cared about all people. And some of my teachers there were white, and some of them are still friends today. We share a very rich friendship we have shared throughout the years. Having gone to a school like the Lincoln High School with high standards, I was able to get a scholarship to Antioch College in Ohio. My sister had been given the first scholarship of a black student to Antioch College. First time that Antioch had accepted blacks on a completely integrated basis, and she had gone 2 years ahead of me. This was one way of getting out of the South and to freeing myself. I saw this opportunity to free myself by leaving the South that was much more, that was segregated, and that my activities would be circumscribed. Plus, it was felt that the educational standards, and they were much higher outside of the South than inside of the South. So that Antioch provided a whole new world for me, and it was from that experience at Antioch that I feel that I was prepared really to lead the kind of life I later led when we returned to Montgomery. My husband was asked to serve as spokesman for the movement that started in 1955, the bus boycott, and certainly for whatever my life has been since then. I feel that there's much to be learned from the whole black experience and the even the black family, because I think sometimes we tend to feel that blacks don't have families. Unusual for a black family to have a father and a mother in the home. Well, in the situation where I grew up, I was trying to think whether or not I knew that many blacks who didn't have two parents in the home. And in my immediate community, I couldn't think of hardly any, except in cases where one of the parents had died. So I think that is remarkable in itself, and I'm sure it might be rather revealing to some people to feel that those conditions do exist for blacks. But there are other communities similar to mine across the South, and so that in many ways it was not that unique. I feel privileged to have had that kind of experience, I know that there are many in urban centers families that are broken, but that's a part of the urban existence, more so than is peculiar to, you know, the pattern in black life and culture. I often say that in order to understand a Martin Luther King Jr., you have to understand his roots and his family background. Martin Luther King Jr. for many people was a phenomenon. They never realized that there was a family background, family roots that go back for a couple of generations in which you could trace his directly, his heritage, and also one might have predicted with that kind of background, maybe, that Martin Luther King Jr. could have emerged. I often say that sometimes it appears that black people don't have families, they just sort of happen. But I think if we study life of black families, we will find that black families, like white families, have the same kinds of struggles and problems, and those at the same economic levels have the same kinds of experiences. And in the South, this is very true. When you visit in the Deep South, in those communities that have not been urbanized, you will find the similarities quite striking between black life in the rural South and the life of whites in the rural South. Thank God the conditions have changed so that as far as this pattern of segregation is concerned, I think we've seen as a result of the nonviolent movement for social change, instead of having two separate lifestyles, there is beginning to emerge a kind of single lifestyle. Not that blacks have lost their identity, so that blacks and whites are coming together in dialogue and they're working on their common problems. And we see it in the structure of the government. We see it in a city like Atlanta, where you have a government that's half black and half white, black mayor. And you see it in many other instances in smaller communities across the South. So we can say that the black family structure has played an important role in producing positive individuals who have, I think, who've become models for not only for other black children, but for boys and girls of any group. And we can be very proud of some of those persons whose names I will not mention, but I'm sure that you are sophisticated enough to know some of those and who they are, and some of them have been on this campus. I am not meaning to sound defensive, but I think that it is important to recognize these contributions for what they are. And since this is a class in black families, I think it might be appropriate to say these things. Now, I would, I have not covered a lot of my past. It would take all day to do that. But I would be happy to entertain questions that you might want to ask about certain aspects of that past, or any other questions that I might be able to answer. I won't promise you that I can answer all of them. It was rough. It was, I was very, very frustrated because my preparation had not been adequate for Antioch. And though I graduated as valedictorian of my class, I still had very, very great difficulty reading and comprehending what I read. So I had to take a course in remedial reading, and I found myself working very hard trying to keep up. It took me, I guess, the first couple of years to kind of, you know, get adjusted. But after the first couple of years, I began to feel much more comfortable. And I also had to seek some counseling help. But it was a very difficult experience. But one thing I discovered is that I was not the only person who was having difficulty, that many other freshmen were, and that it wasn't because I was inferior. You know, that was one of the things that I had to deal with. It wasn't because I was inferior, but because that I had not had the kind of background which would have prepared me to do the kind of work that was required in Antioch.
Recently, we have had a mock KKK protest of affirmative action on the campus. And I was wondering if you feel there's any possibility of reverse discrimination with affirmative action.
I'm not sure I understand enough of the...
She's not familiar with what has happened on campus.
Yeah, I don't know enough of the background to give you an informed opinion on that.
On the national scene, dealing with reverse discrimination, if you're familiar with the granting of going into law school because of color of the skin, various other granting of funds because of color, dealing with affirmative action, dealing with past discrimination.
Do you think there's any laws against affirmative action? Well, I feel that in order to correct the wrongs of the past, very often you have to make some, and this is some accommodation, I suppose you'd say, to minorities and other people who have been the victims of a system which did not permit them, to be involved and participants of that system. Initially, so that I do not feel that it's quite appropriate consideration in this regard. Otherwise, I think it's like saying to sort of lift yourself by your own bootstraps. My husband used to say that you cannot expect people to somehow catch up without giving them some help to help them catch up. Yes?
I'm wondering, as a mother, how did you tell your children to deal with the problem of, I think there was several threats on your husband's life, so he came with. How did you deal with that towards your children?
I didn't hear. How did I deal with?
How did you deal with the bomb threats or the threats that were made upon your life?
The young, during those years when we received most of the threats, explain what happened, essentially. But we had created a kind of attitude of what our involvement were. They understood that their father was trying to bring about the kind of changes in the early years. It was explained to them in terms of of making things better for those people who don't have those kinds of things. The threats, we didn't have to explain until understand pretty much that there was the problem that your dad was comfortable about, and they had their prejudices. And you know, you have prejudice in all groups, so that's the way it was dealt with. And as I said, I don't remember ever having to answer that particular question. You know, why is Daddy being threatened? I had to answer the question, why is it that some people don't like Daddy? And I said, you know, it's not that they don't like him, they don't like what he's doing, and there is a difference. And then, you know, go into some explanation of what it is he's doing that's positive.
Given what has happened in the past and the present in the United States, how would you paint a picture of race relations in the future? I mean, what would you envision the United States to be 20 years from now?
I think that what the future portends depends on, to a large extent, what each one of us as individuals will do about it. It isn't going to happen. Things are not going to change automatically. I think if we are concerned about the conditions we have to work at changing them in our way, and each one of us can work in our own way every day of our lives. The conditions have improved since 1955, but they just didn't happen. It was because there were concerned individuals who were willing to dedicate themselves toward bringing about these changes, and who were willing to sacrifice, and some to even die, to bring about these changes. So that in 20 years, this country could have moved pretty far along towards solving many of the social problems, provided there are enough concerned individuals who are working at it every day. And this means getting people involved at the level of policies where they are going to make decisions that are going to affect those people who have been on the end of deprivation in a positive manner, and people who are going to be concerned about, you know, the whole thrust of this country to make it a more democratic and just society. Well. Yes, I would say that it was very heartwarming to find out that officially that all these things had been happening. And you say we had known it all along, but it was also gratifying in a sense to know that much of what had been particularly that affecting my husband had been rumored, that there was an effort to discredit him rather than an effort really to discover what the truth was. And I think the revelations of the investigations helped, I think, to vindicate my husband. And that was very gratifying for me. busing is beneficial to white children?
Black children.
Black children. Well, I happen to feel that the issue is not busing. It's a very difficult thing to, when you talk about busing or not busing, I think the issue happens to be whether or not we are going to invest in enough in our educational system so that we can raise the level of all of, you know, our education. And if it seems to me if we were concentrating on the right thing, the busing question wouldn't be an issue. But the fact is that it is an issue. And for many people, sometimes you have to bus in order to get the kind of balanced education that is needed. But busing in itself is not going to solve the educational problem. I happen to believe that, you know, that there was much more busing. Busing is an old institution in our society. I mean, you know, many, many people have been bused across the years, and there was no issue until we began to integrate children. And I think that is the question. It's a question still of whether or not the country is going to deal with the issue of race and quality for everybody. And that's the way I feel about it. I think that some schools, black schools, may be much better than some white schools. But I believe if we made all of our schools better schools, there wouldn't be a question of busing. People would be bused readily to a good school. I'm not, at this point, I'm not supporting anyone. I think it's still difficult to see who will be the front runner and who will get the nomination. I have a policy of not supporting candidates in the primary stage. I think that it's difficult now anyway, and I'm still, you know, observing to see which way things are going to be moving. I saw a young man right here in the front row that raised his hand. Do you still want to ask a question? Could you speak a little louder? That he said, do I know his aunt? Aunt Babe. I don't know that I do. Where does she live? Oh, she lived in Montgomery, Alabama. Well, I might. I don't. Anybody else? Yes. Young lady here.
Oh, I was going to ask you, do you feel there is such thing as reverse discrimination?
Well, you know, there could be, but I mean, that's an open-ended question. It has to relate to something.
Discrimination because of the affirmative action program of the Michigan States. And we've been having quite a few discussions about whether there is such a thing as reverse discrimination or does reverse discrimination exist as far as black people are beginning to discriminate against white people and that white people are becoming discriminated against.
Well, you know, I think that you have to, you'd have to see a particular situation to determine whether or not there is reverse discrimination. But, you know, I can, I can conceive of such a situation, but I cannot talk about what's here because I don't know enough about it. Unfortunately, I cannot say. It would seem to me that such a small percentage, relatively, of blacks on the campus, I don't see how you could have that kind of a problem.
I'd like to thank Mrs. Coretta Scott King for sharing with us.